Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to In Bed. I'm your host, Sue Storm, and I'm going to start this show with a kinky question. Yes, I usually answer your kinky questions at the end of the show, and I will again on this one. But this particular question that was sent in is a perfect way to introduce today's topic. So here's the question. It was sent in by Shame-Based Inquirer. And they ask, through therapy and research, I've found that my sexual identity comes from a place of toxic shame. This would be fine, but the shame comes from a toxic place that leads to isolation and withdrawal, and masturbation used more for self-soothing rather than healthy exploration. Have you experienced this issue with your counseling background? And if so, what would you suggest as the first step in moving into a healthier direction? Ask and you shall receive. The universe is wonderful. Lucky for you, Shame-Based Inquirer, that is what my guest is here to discuss with everybody. We're going to delve into healing from sexual and religious shame with my guest, Dr. Tina Shermer-Sellers, who quite literally wrote the book on overcoming sexual shame. You're about to see how the matrix, or society if you will, has been programming you from day one to be ashamed of your sexuality, all in the quest for money. Sounds wild, but Dr. Shermer-Sellers lays it out very easily and also gives you some help to turn that programming around in order to enjoy life and, dare I say it, be happy. It's absolutely fascinating how much we are all controlled. But when you rip the lid off that container, you see for yourself how these feelings you have are not of your own making, and that by living our true selves, we can let go of shame and finally move in the direction our hearts were meant to be going in. Here is my interview with Dr. Tina Shermer-Sellers. Thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your knowledge with my listeners. Many of my listeners are dealing with sexual shame and childhood sexual shame from things such as child abuse or sexual abuse, or even having a simple fetish. What got you interested in the subject of sexual shame?
Well, it's a kind of a fun, convoluted story. I taught for 28 years in a graduate marriage and family therapy program and was an expert in medical family therapy and women's health, just, you know, a few things. And early on in my career, I was told that we needed someone to teach the graduate human sexuality class. Mm-hmm. And none of the other professors that had been there longer than I had wanted to teach it. And it was a required course for licensure in the state of Washington, which is where I was. And I just jumped at it. At the time, I didn't think much of it, except for I kind of was curious as to why my colleagues weren't more excited about teaching that class. Because to me, that was one of the most fun subjects to teach. So anyway, so I started teaching that class. I would have the students write their sexual autobiography. That was one of their assignments. Now, a lot of times when people hear that, they're like, oh, my Lord, have mercy. I can't imagine ever doing something like that. But, you know, if you're going to be a therapist, you're only ever as good as you know your own stories, where you begin and end and your clients begin and end. And that is clear to you. And in America, where we haven't had comprehensive sex education ever, and it's only been, you know, abstinence only for the last 45 years, for the most part. We only have 18 states who have passed laws that require their sex education to be medically accurate, if they even have any. So I thought it was a really important assignment. And they had gotten used to writing assignments about themselves in other courses, things on gender or family of origin or things like that. So around the year I started teaching this class in 1992. And in around the year 2000, I noticed there was a dramatic shift in the tone of these papers. So not so much what they were saying. That was falling in that range of common stories that you tend to hear as people are describing their sexual development. I would ask them, you know, what did you learn from your parents, from your grandparents, about affection and touch and bodies and gender and stuff like that. But then I actually guided them through with questions through their childhood, adolescence, and where they were in their adulthoods. And then I invited them to examine, as they looked at this story, as they had put it down as a narrative, what did they think of the legacy? Is this a legacy that they wish to bring forward, or is there things that they want to change? So this tone began to change in around the year 2000, and I wasn't sure exactly what I was seeing, but they were describing a similar story, but with this sense of humiliation and disgust toward themselves, a belief that something was wrong with them, that they were perverted in some way, that whatever they thought or felt or did or didn't do even, that something was wrong, that it was saying something horribly negative about them. So just a lot of self-hatred. And it just broke my heart. I just didn't understand.
I was just going to say, that is really sad to see that shift. That's sad.
It is terribly sad. I mean, I would literally sit in the chair in my chair's office and cry because it was so heartbreaking. What I hadn't come to realize at that point in my life, because I was still fairly young, is that I had grown up in a sex positive home. My grandparents are Swedish immigrants. There's been generations of sex and body positivity in that family. And so I didn't realize that I was the one that grew up in an odd family. I had grandparents, great aunts and uncles, parents that I could ask anything to. They talked about these things all the time. It was like talking about a recipe.
You know, that's brilliant. And that is rare.
It is rare. Man, is that rare. I didn't realize it at that point. And that's why I think my heart broke so much. Mm-hmm. Because I thought, oh my gosh, this is one of the most precious parts of you. Like it's how you love. You were given a body and you're able to love with it. You're able to do things with it. You're able to explore and create. It's fantastic. I mean, I'm very much aware, and was even then, about what culture was doing with regard to a consumer-based, materialistically-based culture. But I just thought, I guess more people were given more encouragement. And so what I came to find out as I began to ask questions and talk more deeply with my students and with my clients was that I was hitting the first wave of folks that had gone through abstinence-only education. Some had been exposed to the purity movement. And we know now that abstinence education and the purity movement can be really absorbed by people that are especially earnest or anxious, you know, just in their general personality, can be absorbed and manifest in symptoms that look like somebody who's experienced childhood sexual abuse. Right. And that's what I was seeing, and that's what I was hearing, and that's what was breaking my heart. And so I literally took kind of a right turn with regard to my research. I had been doing a lot of research in medicine, and I took a right turn and I started studying this and reading everything I could, writing about it, speaking about it, because I'm like, is anybody talking about the fact that we are hurting our kids across the board in powerful ways right now? And then I wrote an article in 2006, and I was approached by a progressive journal called The Other Journal, Intersection of Theology and Culture. And so I titled the article, Christians Caught Between the Sheets, How Abstinence-Only Ideology Hurts Us. And at that point, the article went viral.
That was really good.
And I heard from people from around the globe. What I don't think I realized when I wrote that article was how we as a country in 1980 had really begun to merge church and state and had begun to put religious education in schools around sexuality. Really, it was all about sex is dangerous and it's going to kill you. And if you don't give all of your power over to the people with the power, you're somehow going to, you know, ruin your life and ruin your future and ruin everything, you know? So at that point, I sort of thought it was more just around people that had brushed up against evangelical Christianity, but I've come to realize it's much broader than that.
Oh, it's hugely broader than that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Can you explain how the patriarchy feeds this sexual shame?
Well, the patriarchy is about power and control. We have long seen, just even looking at the development of the empire church, you know, from the Christian church from the fourth century forward, when Constantine became the emperor, or Constantine was the emperor, he became a Christian, quote unquote, and he then had the power to start appointing leaders of this church. They were vying for power based on how they could deny the body. And so it was still all about power. It was all about power and control. And that's the basic formation of the Christian empire institutionalized religion. It's about power and control. And it's really just, that's the heart of it. And whenever you see patriarchy and how patriarchy is touched things, when there's no balance of sort of the balance of the feminine or the balance of the matriarchy with it, then you see a lot of decisions being made that are around how do we control people so that we can get what we want. So what was happening in 1980 is we had the first evidence of AIDS on the East Coast, then West Coast in 85. We had an economic downturn. We had a huge reaction to second wave feminism from the 60s and 70s. And so you had a scared populace. And whenever you have a scared populace, they are ripe for being taken control of. And when the religious right and all the evangelicals couldn't keep segregation away from the Christian schools anymore, it became against the law to do that, then they had to pick another issue to rally the voter base. And so they chose the issue of abortion. Most people don't know that the Southern Baptist Church was in favor of Roe v. Wade until 1980. Then it chose this, and there were a bunch of politicians involved, and then there were a bunch of political religious leaders involved, like Jerry Falwell Paul Weyrich and other folks like this. And it really became a smokescreen. Family values became a smokescreen to growing capitalism. Because at that very same time, we started to remove the regulations on the media, the FCC. We passed some huge laws to take the regulations that were protecting the public away. We did the same thing with the banks. And then we began to see this slow but very deliberate turn towards the ends, making money for our stockholders, justifies however justifies the means. So we began to see a movement away from sort of a value in the quality of the products that we produced and a sense of protection of the public, which of course was not perfect by any stretch, right? Away from, in other words, the means justify the ends. How we do something matters. We began to move away from that with Reagan into the ends. Making money is more important than how we do it. So how we do it doesn't matter. And we began to see you could say anything you wanted in the media. It didn't matter if it was a lie, as long as it got you more viewers. And we have now been on that train for 45 years, and we have seen how it has broken apart, literally broken apart our country.
I was just going to say, is that not like we're looking at this runaway train right now that it has now gained so much speed?
Yeah.
That's where all the divisiveness is coming from. And
that's right.
You know, the religious right and now Roe v. Wade and all of it. It's just, it's fascinating.
It is. And I think it's important to understand that meanwhile, we've had technology kind of on a runaway train too, which doesn't have to be a bad thing, but when it's on this set of values that products are more important than people, then it is a problem. And so we had video games coming on the scene in about 85 or so with much more violence against women. Same with music videos. And then we had online pornography. Pornography's been around forever. It's not any more a problem. It doesn't need to be than money is. But again, when it's built on this platform of money is what matters, then we do whatever sells, right? Again, we start to see in free pornography this incredible increase in violence against women. I mean, you can watch gay porn till the cows come home and you will not see humiliation and exploitation like you will see in straight free porn. It's absolutely stunning. And then we had cable TV, and then we had the internet, you know, as it was all growing, and then we have social media. So we have technology, and some of that stuff could be and is wonderful. But when it's built on this set of values that it doesn't matter what you do as long as you make money for your investors, then you start to see where you're literally going after destroying your populace. Because
what the populace, what end though? This is what doesn't make sense. To what end? Why are you destroying the populace? There's your money.
I think that's not thinking. They're not thinking long term. They're thinking short term.
Yeah.
It's all about let's make the money, sell the company, go.
Right.
It's not long term. none of this is long. I mean, shoot, our healthcare system has been on a track to fall apart since the beginning of my career. We used to talk about it in medical conferences all the time. And now we're watching. You know, they predicted, this was back in, I don't know, late 90s, that by 2025, the premiums and out-of-pocket expenses that people were paying for their healthcare would begin to equal what they were bringing home. The average American was bringing home, and we are there.
Yep.
We are there. And where was it going to go from here? It's just going to, I mean, things are going to get more desperate because we don't have leaders. We don't have people in power who care. They, in fact, they live a life that is unrecognizable by the average American, completely unrecognizable. And that's dangerous. There's a fairly good documentary by the Representation Project who did misrepresentation and the mask you live in, which are on gender issues and the effect on girls and boys. But they did one called The Great American Lie. And what I love about their documentaries is they ground it all in research. Like you can, they will give you everything you can look up yourself. And it shows what laws began to be passed in the 80s and continued on. And then how the average income of the average American began to change by those that were in corporate America, the C-suite people. And it went from like a 40% difference to like 5,000% difference. So now we've got people in power, because money is power, who are making decisions that actually are breaking the back of the average American.
And it's no wonder everyone's walking around with shame.
Yeah, exactly. And then how do people then do intimacy, then do connection and pleasure, then do happiness, right? If they're so spent and they feel so discouraged, but then they've also grown up with media being their primary educator, right, but no actual education to help them differentiate between fantasy and reality, right?
And that's huge.
We've set them up. We've set the average American up for a very fraught interpersonal relationship or intimate relationship. Very fraught, especially straight folks. You know, so many queer folks have been fighting their way out for so long, and they're not handed a here's how you do sexuality. They get to ask, hey, what are you into? Mm-hmm. You know, but not straight folks, not at all.
No, and like you said, there is no, I was discussing that with a client not that long ago, that there really is, we just kind of dump everyone out there and go flounder sexually. Right. No one's given a handbook. No one's, and if you base your sexuality on all the porn you've been watching,
right,
now you wonder why you can't connect with women, why you can't, you know, the relationships are falling apart.
Right.
How does childhood sexual trauma work in with shame?
Well, again, I think trauma is what we know about trauma, right, is it overwhelms the nervous system.
Right.
And so the body, because it tries to help us survive, bless, it's such a good thing.
It is.
You know, it goes and it does whatever it needs to do to help protect you. It puts like a blanket around you. And and so you might go into fantasy, or you might go, you know, who knows, you're going to go to places. And because your nervous system needs to protect itself and it needs to shut down to some degree. But the problem is it affects your deep emotional system. So like your amygdala, it affects your brain. It affects your whole way in which you process information from that point forward. And so a loud noise happens, and now you don't respond from a place of safety. You respond from a place of danger, right? And this is woven all into your body, into your whole system, because it's visceral. It's in your body. And we actually did our first piece of research on sexual shame in 2017. And we got an amazing operational definition, because we didn't have one. And I'd be happy to share that with you and your listeners if you want. But it really underscores how this is visceral. It's in your body. And so if you have experienced childhood sexual abuse, some adult imposed their sexual thinking on your body, and or as you, as a little sweet little thing, were discovering your body, you're a year old and your diapers are off, or you're in the tub and you find your genitals. What a glorious day for you. What a glorious moment, right? But if you have someone there who yells, screams, get a scary face, says gross, don't, slaps your hand away, you don't understand what just happened. You just know that this person that represents all safety and provision for you has just gotten angry with you. And you don't have the cognitive development to stop doing that. I mean, you'll stop do it right then, right? Because you're getting your diaper back on or you're getting your jammies on or whatever. But you're going to do it hundreds of times more until you're about 4 or 5 when you start to log in memory in a more significant way. And then you'll start going underground with it. But just imagine how many times that's happened in your very natural curiosity up until that point, right? Mm-hmm. You ask people, when do you, tell me what you remember about your childhood developing sexuality. And they'll often say, oh, I remember getting in trouble for playing with my cousin or something, you know, mm-hmm. when I was 5. Well, that's because your brain was finally able to store that memory in a way that was more lasting. And so that's what you remember. But trust me, if that's the environment that you were in, it happened thousands of times probably before that point. Because we are hardwired as humans for connection and pleasure. We come out of the womb rooting towards the breast, right? Because we can smell something there. We feel the body, but the milk isn't there for 2 or 3 days, right? It's hardwired in us. We know if little toddlers aren't given enough physical touch, warm, loving physical touch, they can suffer neurological damage. Walk down the halls of an Alzheimer's unit, and you're going to find people without memory, but seeking connection and pleasure. It is mm-hmm. as core to the human experience as anything, right?
And is that the reason why with some people who have different neurological disorders, such as Lewy body, things like that, that you will find them almost with a Tourette's-like thing saying, you know, blow me, right, out of nowhere? Is that where that's coming from? Like there's
that
just
could
this
be
sexual
that,
connection.
Or it could be that people have reacted, and so that's getting logged more in the brain because of the reactivity from other people.
Ah, okay.
Because blow me or some kind of, you know, statement like that isn't demonstrating connection and pleasure, right? But likely it is eliciting reactions
a
from
response.
People. And so that is affecting the brain. Yeah, absolutely.
Got it.
Yeah.
How do you heal from this though? Like, how can you heal from all of this shame? I mean, we haven't even touched on religious shame. Like
that alone is
massive.
Right. That just adds a whole nother massive layer on top of this for people. Well, the work that I did and in the book I wrote, Sex, God, and the Conservative Church, Erasing Shame from Sexual Intimacy, I have a chapter in there about healing shame. And this really grew out. It took 11 years to write that book. And I was working on models while I was, you know, treating people and stuff while I was writing that book. And so I have a model called Healing the Mess, the model for erasing sexual shame, MESS. And there are 4 kind of components to it that you're doing over and over and over again. And it's allowing the shame to really kind of melt away. So the 4 areas are frame, name, claim, and aim. Frame is first, give yourself a scaffolding of sex education. I wrote a second book, and I wrote it because I had parents asking me, I don't want to do to my kids what was done to me. Can you help me? And I said, yeah, I'll write you a book. I'll make it so you feel like I'm holding your hand. And so I did birth to 2, 2 to 4, 4 to 6, all the way up to 18, said, here's developmentally what most kids are trying to accomplish emotionally and how it expresses itself behaviorally and what their body and sort of sexual curiosities are and how they express themselves. Then I invite the people who are reading it to ask themselves, how is this similar or different to when you grew up? How do people respond to you? If they didn't respond in these ways, I'm suggesting kids need, and here are all the top books for kids and the top books for adults. If you didn't get this, what did you get? And if you had gotten that, how might that have been different from you? So I wrote it for parents, but what I keep hearing from people is there's so many people that end up picking this book up or someone gives it to them who grew up in a home that was really sex negative or shame-based. And they're saying, I'm reparenting myself. I'm going and getting these books at the library. And I'm learning I was okay all along. Like every step of the way, I was so right on track with my curiosity. I just didn't know it. And so this is how this first piece, it's really about get yourself that sex education. So you find out that you are normal, you are fine, your curiosities are fine, you know, and you can then begin to differentiate between fantasy and reality. Like, oh, no wonder this porn over here, I love watching it, or it really appeals to my fantasies or appeals to my kinks or whatever. But it also isn't what I'm doing over here or want to do or my partner wants to do. And so But that, and that's okay. They can be different. They don't have to be the same, you know, or you can just see the difference between fantasy and reality. That can be really helpful to people. So that's frame. Name is tell your story to someone, find a group of friends, find a therapist, a coach, someone that you can say, here's what it was like for me growing up in my family, my community, my school, my church, my whatever. This is what I heard. And let them give you compassion and empathy and some basic understanding so that you can begin to, it's not in secret anymore. It's out in the open and you're being loved in your story. And shame just really has a hard time standing up mm-hmm. when it's, you know, really heard like that. So that's name. Claim is claim your body is good. I tell people all the time, however your body is, whatever shape it is, whatever age you are, has more to do with your heredity and your ethnicity than it has to do with anything else. And it's not that how we eat or how we move isn't important, but it is not as important as the diet industry wants you to believe that it is. And there are some people whose bodies are going to look like this, and there are some people whose bodies are going to like this. But if you get to get up in the morning and you're not in super bad pain, you get to go love with your body. You get to go create with your body. You get to go live and smell and breathe and see and enjoy all five of your senses. It's a good day, and your body is a good day. And you don't want to be hating your body the way that our marketing culture wants you to, so that you keep driving our economy by buying more things, but then getting to your deathbed and realizing you never appreciated this incredible body that you had. So I'm like, work on claiming it. I know it's harder than it's probably harder to do than it sounds, but it is so worth doing. So work on claiming your body as good. As you do this frame, name, and claim, what you're going to find you're going to slowly do is you're going to be deconstructing this negative sex is dangerous, you're dangerous kind of idea that you might have grown up with, and you're going to begin forming a whole new legacy. You're going to be aiming for a new legacy, and it's something that you can then share with people around you, and especially little ones, and helping them have a different experience than you had. And I'm often saying to people, as somebody who came from a Swedish background, I can tell you, you can change this in one generation. And if you then keep it going, that bodies are good, people and their desires and their curiosities are good. And yes, we do have to be mindful and we have to be disciplined. Like our desires need to serve, I always say desires need to serve love and justice, not just you. You know, and they certainly shouldn't hurt other people. I like that. So yeah, that's one way. And there are other ways too, but at least that gets people off the ground. That gets them started in this shame healing process. Yeah.
Okay. Let's get into religion.
A recent thing I heard, which I thought was really interesting because it seemed to fit what I'm seeing, is that we've got as much as 20% of the population right now describing that they are deconstructing the faith that they grew up with. They are asking questions about, was what I learned just as I was told that it was, or has it been actually destructive? And if it's been destructive to me, how and where has it been destructive to me? We have so many books that have come out since my book came out in 2017. We've probably had, I don't know, 40, 50 books that have come out on the deconstructing journey and how conservative religion is hurtful to people. And I had a scholar friend who looked at conservative religions globally, but they had more similarities than differences. So what is at the core of conservative religions globally is patriarchy. It's about power and control.
Now we're back to control.
That's right. It's giving that power and control over to someone other than you. And if you go to the ancient wisdoms, what the shamans have been writing about for years, you are in direct communication with the source. Mm-hmm. The source has always been speaking to your heart. In fact, in my book, I give a chapter on some of the beautiful writing in ancient Jewish writing. And the belief is when a child is born, when a baby is born and it takes its first breath out of the womb, that is the in-breath, the inspiration, the in-spirit of God, of source coming into the human body. And it is coursing through the human body, through desire, like leading you to, I think I want to try this. I think I want to do this. And you can see this in children, can see it in people that follow their dreams and go and pursue things. It's coursing through your body until your last breath, which is the expiration or the outgoing spirit. And that is part of what's in you. So it's always been you and source. It's never been or source within you. It's never been or God within you or however you want to say it, the divine. However, that has always been the way it is. And that matches the ancient wisdoms too. It does not match patriarchy because patriarchy would lose control if people right. started calling them out. And that happens and is happening. It's just that there aren't enough people in power, it feels like, doing that enough to break some of this, slow this train down a bit.
It just, I know that there's a lot of gentlemen who listen to my show who have an addiction, if you will, to being humiliated, feeling that shame. And there's a lot of porn around that as well.
Well, I think you have
to. If you sexualize the shame, how do you break that?
Well, I think you have to look, I mean, every situation can be so different. You know, there can be situations where that is part of their fetish, part of their kink, part of what they enjoy, and it actually brings them pleasure. And it's not breaking down their life or their joy or their pursuits or how they're doing things. Like, they're still thriving. They're still doing things. This is just something that they kind of like. We need to make space for that. If it's,
but do you think indulging in that is negative to the self-esteem? Is it negative to your own psyche?
If it is negative to the self-esteem and that is evident to them, then you can work on worth issues, but it's not for everybody. And that's, I think, important for people to know. Cause you know, as you know, I'm sure therapists don't get training in sexuality, sexual health, nope. and understanding their sexual biases. Doctors don't get training in sexual health. And
well, the DSM, I mean, my God, don't. It wasn't till not that long ago that they were still saying that if you were gay, it was, you had a mental disorder. Right. It's still so very archaic.
Well, and our training is still siloed.
Yep.
And we still carve out, I mean, you can study to be a physical therapist and we'll not study the pelvic region, male or female. You have to go on to do specialized training. And it's the same for therapists. And that's why therapists, I think, like Esther Perel or Terry Real are so popular, because they are trained in bio, psycho, social, spiritual, sexual.
Right.
Which is what the human condition is. But most of our clinicians are not. And so they're often feeding into some of the poor self-esteem, if you will, of their clients, or feeding the shame, because they're coming in with a something that the therapist doesn't understand.
Well, that's just it. And then you will also get the therapist's own values thrown in there, right. as well, absolutely. Right? Like, you'll have, oh, well, no, right. that's absolutely deviant. You can't do something like that.
Right. And I'm often saying, you know, if you grew up in this time frame as a clinician, then you got this sex is dangerous thing, hook, line, and sinker.
Yep.
And if you haven't looked at your own story, then you are likely causing harm. Even though I know you don't intend to.
No, I agree with you 100%.
That you are. Yeah. I mean, there's so many people that believe that your partner can diagnose you as having a porn addiction. And that is baloney.
Mm-hmm.
It's just.
Oh, they all know. Everyone self-diagnoses now. I can't tell you how many go.
Yeah. But again, you're looking at the back. You're looking at the backdrop. Are you self-diagnosing because people around you are telling you that it's terrible?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, really? So you haven't, the first thing I always say is, so have you been clinically told this? Well, no. Oh, okay.
Well, yeah. But the thing is, even if I asked that question and they saw a CSAT therapist, certified sex addiction therapist.
Yeah, true.
They have, CSAT has only like maybe 2 hours of sex education training in their entire training.
Whoop-dee-doo.
And they have no bias training in there. So bias is, what are your ideas about A, B, C, D, and E. None. I don't even ask that.
If you do go into therapy, I always recommend, if you don't feel good with your therapist, if you're feeling off in any way, find another therapist. It's
absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. You're hiring a contractor.
Exactly. And this is dealing with you, your mind. It's the most important contract.
And your heart.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, my dear, thank you so much. How can people get in touch with you? What if they want to have like a one-on-one session or something?
I don't do one-on-one sessions.
Okay.
I started an institute 9 years ago called the Northwest Institute on Intimacy. You can follow it at NW Institute on Intimacy on Instagram or go to their website at nwioi.com. And if you go to the resources section and go to providers, we have medical providers and therapy providers that are trained in this holistic, the way that humans are put together. They're trained in sexuality. They're trained in spirituality. They can go with you wherever you need to go. And I send everybody there because I can't handle it all, obviously. And so I do more clinical supervision. I do clinical supervision for folks across the country. And that's how I do my work. If they want to follow me, I have a website, which is my name, TinaShermerSellers.com. On it, I have lots of free stuff, including a thing called the Sexual Reclamation Project, where you can download a PDF and do your own investigating on how you grew up and how you feel about how you grew up. I just give you tons of questions and things to think about. It's a really great eye-opening experience to take yourself through. So that's on that website. I also can be followed at Dr. Dr. Tina Shameless on Instagram, where I post lots of stuff and have lots of free stuff and lots of podcasts and just education, you know, all kinds of things there. And then for anybody that happens to have gotten into it, I have recently launched a new organization called InannaRising.org, I-N-A-N-N-A. RISING.org. And it's for clinicians that have gone on to get training in psychedelic assisted therapy, which is really the next frontier as far as healing PTSD and trauma. And I'm, again, particularly interested in religious trauma and how to heal that with people. So the role that medicines can play in that. And
we're talking like ketamine.
Ketamine, MDMA, mushrooms, which could be legal in August.
The ayahuasca, I should say.
Ayahuasca, right? There's ayahuasca, which you have to leave the country for right now anyway. And then psilocybin, which is decriminalized and legal in some states, but it's just showing such remarkable results in helping people get relief from trauma and trauma symptoms. Like people are showing after going through the MAPS trials, which was three medicines of MDMA and then a bunch of therapy before and in between and after, but still like 12 sessions. When I say a bunch of therapy, it's not like what people are sometimes doing. 12 sessions and a year later, they are still symptom free.
Wow.
On PTSD.
Fabulous.
And if we could free people, this is really what I'm about now. If we could really get this out to the people that are hurting and free them to live the life they were meant to live and pursue the things that their heart wants to pursue, we could save our planet. We could save our country. We could, we literally could, because we'd have so many more people who are healthy and happy and now have the gumption to say, hey, I'm not okay with you treating people this way, or I'm not okay with passing laws that do this, or, you know, we'll have people that have the strength to stand up and say, Let's get better. Let's do better for all of us and for our kids and our grandkids. You know, they deserve. I live in a forest. I would like to see people still be able to play in the forest.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much, Dr. Tina, for being here and sharing your wisdom with us. I'm going to make sure that all of those links are available on the In Bed with Dr. Sue website.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Shame-based inquirer, I do hope this gives you a start on your journey to heal from this type of programming. And for anyone wanting to let go of sexual or religious shame, I urge you to get Dr. Tina Shermer Sellers' books, Sex, God, and the Conservative Church, Erasing Shame from Sexual Intimacy. That's the first one. And for those of you wanting to raise sexually confident children, please pick up Dr. Tina's book, Shameless Parenting, Everything You Need to Raise Shame-Free, Confident Kids, and heal your shame, too. I have the links to the books and all the organizations that Dr. Tina mentioned on the InBed website for this show. Now, it's time for questions. You guys always send them in, but naturally this time you guys all had to wait for the literal last day to send. can always count on you guys to leave everything to the last minute. I swear my listeners procrastinate more than I do, and that's not an easy thing to do. Okay, first question is from Beast, our Beastie pal. He says, not just a question, but a comment and question. From what I've seen and heard over the years, most white males tend to fall into three subgroups, namely sissy cuckold, pain sluts, or non-sexual service subs. Okay, I can see where you're coming off with that, but I think you're trying to put people into groups. The subgroups aren't working for me. Let me tell you why. Sissy is on its own. Sissy's on its own. I just think sissy is its own thing. Cuckolding. Now, if you're going to take cuckolding and you want to group it with something, I would group cuckolding with the whole BBC thing now and, you know, the whole pussy-free thing. And yeah, you got your pain slut, so you've got, obviously, your masochists are in there as well. And non-sexual service subs. There's not a lot of those. Let's face it, white guys are out for, you know, themselves. I'm sorry, I know you guys hate it when I do that, but we have to look at it as a generalization. I'm not saying every white guy, I mean, my husband's a great guy. I'm not saying you're all this way. I'm saying, generally speaking, white guys have had everything handed to them. So they tend to be very selfish. They don't realize they're being selfish, but they are. And it's just something, again, this is all based on programming. We program white males to be these, you know, you got to get out there and, you know, like I say, you got to get out there and beat the woolly mammoth and do whatever you got to do. It's not to say that you don't put that on all males. I think we do to a certain degree. White males more so, because they are the ones that the church and those in power want to keep in power, right? Like, who's running the show? White guys everywhere. Old white guys everywhere. So when, and yes, there's white women in there too. But again, we're generalizing, right? So white guys, meh. The problem is what's happening now and why white guys were also very pissed off about Me Too is because we're calling you on the programming now. So in Bella's case, and Bella will be up shortly, in Bella's case, when she gets angry about the wokeness of things, what you're seeing with wokeness, and I don't like using those words because it's stupid, it's also misappropriated, but what you're seeing are people standing up, just as Dr. Tina just said. They're going, you know what? I'm going to start questioning this shit. That's what I want you to see more as wokeness, if you have to use that term. It's people going, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to play this game anymore. I'm not going to, you know, it's like, I'm not going to put up with white guys' bullshit anymore. I'm not going to put up with male bullshit, period. Shit like that. That's what you're seeing. It's not that people are, I'm sure there are some out there that are, you know, using the whole woke thing as stupid, but that's what it's more encompassing people waking up. So let's take woke out, and it's almost like people are waking up to the fact that they are being programmed and they're now questioning everything. In other words, women are programmed all the time to be quiet and nice and submissive and just, you know, as I've told you guys before, all the sexual assaults I have been through, I never thought to report them or do anything because you learn, well, that's the way men are. You just have to learn to navigate it. And that's not true, but that's what we're programmed to think. So that's more what you're looking at. Subgroups, I think subgroups, you could probably come up with 10 subgroups, dude. Seriously, like, I don't think it's fair to throw them into just three little subgroups because everybody is just so individual and so really cool in what they enjoy and what they do. I think it's harder to try and group people. I really do. Because the other thing is, don't forget that sexuality is very fluid and it doesn't matter. We're not talking, oh, it's fluid like, I'm trans or whatever. I don't mean that. I mean sexualness, period. Sex in and of itself is a fluid thing. It's a lot of gray area. So to try to put things into little boxes is probably going to frustrate everybody anyways. But it's not a bad observation. Seriously, it's not a bad observation. I think you're right pretty much. But I don't know. But yeah, I don't know. It's all changing. That's what I mean by fluid. Everything is constantly changing. So you just get used to one thing and then they whip it out from under you and go, nope, we're doing it this way now. So maybe we need to stop trying to put people into groups, even though it helps us. How about that? Sissy Bella is back. Bella's back. Okay, what do we got here, Bella? Dear Miss Dr. Sue, hope that you are well and enjoying life as a superior female as you deserve. Thank you. I actually am. My question this time is more of an idea that I've been thinking about for a long while. The thing is that in couples in the last many years, it has been the rule that both women and men are equal and both have a 50-50 say in how things are run within the family. And of course, that is just all well and good. Or it would seem. Because when you have equality, you have two people both fighting to get their way. That is often how it ends up. Because her girlfriends are always filling her head with talk about how important it is for her to get her way. And it's just the same when the man is hanging out with the guys. Then they tease him if he shows any submissive signs or that he's under his wife's thumb. Of course, each couple should be able to find their own unique way, but it does not seem like society and their friends really allow them to do that, and the pressure is on. And the thing that you can say about FLR or MLR is that there is no doubt who's in charge, so therefore there will be less fighting. When I grew up, Daddy took care of the banking side of the money, but the everyday spending was all Mommy. As with the rest of the running of the family, it was mostly Mommy. The standard answer when us kids asked Daddy for permission for anything was, what did Mom say? So I guess it was kind of like an FLR light thing at my house back in the day. And my Mommy and Daddy had a happy marriage and never fought because there was nothing to debate. Mommy made the decisions and that was that, and it worked really well. So I would love to hear your take on it, Miss Dr. Sue, because just when you watch TV or films, there are never any couples that are living FLR-MLR that are praised for it. On the contrary, it is often problemized if the power is not shared 50-50 on all matters, all details. Okay, what you've touched on here is something that we have discussed with some clients. When we look back, especially when we're looking at things like cuckolding and we look at FLRs, which is female-led relationships, for those who don't understand that, MLR, male-led relationship. When we look at the way it was set up, like let's go back to the 50s, because that's kind of what you've touched on here. When Mommy stayed home, Daddy went to work. Mommy did everything to run the house. Mommy usually was the one that paid the bills and everything. Daddy turned over his check or like had it thrown in the bank. And Mommy did the rest of it. That was really common. It was really, really common. So when we look at, I think it's when the problem is when we start again putting labels on shit, everyone freaks out. Again, it's the same as with grouping stuff, grouping and labeling. We tend to freak out because if we put a label on that and we say, oh, that's a female-led relationship, that makes the male portion of that relationship have no power. And that's not exactly how it went. So I think you can have equality in relationships. For example, I'm going to use mine as an example. Is it more FLR? Yes. I think to say that it is 100% FLR would be incorrect, because every major decision that we make together, and we make sure, like, if it's a major expenditure of some sort, we discuss it together to see what the best route is, It's not like, oh, I'm just going to go out and buy a car. That kind of shit just doesn't go on. That's where your equality is coming in. So I don't think it's that when you, it's like an all or nothing thing. So for you saying, well, it's all or nothing, FLR, MLR, or not, it doesn't work that way. It's a mesh of everything. So you have FLR kind of meshed in there. You have equality meshed in there, because if it hadn't worked, your parents would not have stayed together, right? So clearly, there was an equality base in there for both sides to have felt heard and to have felt validated. Otherwise, you would build resentment and then the marriage goes for a shit. So there's equality, and yes, there is going to be a certain amount of domination and submission within the relationship. We learned that on the last show. And instead of looking at it as dominant and submissive, to look at it more as supportive. So instead of saying, oh, this person is submissive, they're supportive of the leader, if you want to call them a leader, in the relationship, as opposed to completely, because when we think submissive, we think, oh my God, they have absolutely no say and they're slaves and they're, you know, they can't say it. So maybe what we really need to do is start removing the words dominant and submissive from relationships, period, because it's a fluctuation always within that relationship. There is both, there's times when my relationship is MLR. There's shit that needs to be done that I will sit there and go, nope, that's a boy job. Bye. Okay. So he then takes care of that. Do you see what I mean? It's a give and take. It's not so much, well, it's all their way or the highway. It's give and take if you're going to have a successful relationship. So to say, well, yes, FLR or MLR works better than an equal relationship isn't fair. Because if it was full FLR or MLR, then your submissive in that case probably isn't going to be feeling too happy. They're going to be pushed down. It's not, there's no equality. There's no voice. And the first thing I try to teach my male subs is that you have a voice. Submission is not something that you just shut up and take it. That's bullshit. You have a voice. You have the ability to say, you know what, this is working for me, this is not working for me. But so many of you just, again, we throw everything under these umbrellas and these huge freaking, you know, lumps where, well, I have to be this way or this way. I can't be a combination. And we're all a combination of both. We are all dominant and submissive. All of us. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on what's being done at the time. So you can't really say, you know, oh, this works, this doesn't. I think as couples go, it works a little bit better, like you said, if someone in the room has some sort of authority, because otherwise you got two submissives in a relationship and they're both bored out of their tree, which is why a lot of relationships fall apart. They're bored out of their tree because each was expecting the other one to do something and they didn't work. And it just, it ends up falling apart. So I think it's a combination of everything for this to work. The power doesn't have to be shared 50-50 on every single thing. It doesn't have to. She's got her, you know, mom's going to have her way of doing things. Dad's going to have his way of doing things. That's okay as long as the two mesh. So I think I get your point. And I think what you were touching on was very much the old fashioned, you know, beaver cleaver, leave it to beaver friggin' family, right? That it looks as though she is subservient when in fact she was actually running the show. And when you think about it, you talk to most men, even today, to this day, you go, so, you know, what are you doing next weekend, dude? I don't know. I got to check and see what the wife has planned for us. Right there. We automatically do that anyways. But that doesn't make him a sub. He's just, you know, I'm finding out what she wants to do next weekend and I'll let you know. I think we look at things too much when we're in the BDSM community. We look at everything through that lens and you can't. more than anything. That's what I think. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Bella. Okay, now here. Our next question is from Not Sissy Bella. Dear Miss Dr. Sue, is it normal for a sissy with a very tiny willy to take like forever sometimes to reach climax when masturbating when the sissy turns 50 years old? Okay. Science. I love you guys. Stay happy. Definitely not Sissy Bella. Okay. So definitely not Sissy Bella. Is it normal for a sissy with a tiny willy to take forever to reach climax? What that says to me is not, I don't think it's fair to say, well, at 50, you know, everything starts falling apart, because that's not true. So I think if you're having trouble reaching a climax, that usually says to me you're bored. You're bored with what you're thinking of. You need to change things up, switch things around. It's like you're having trouble reaching climax. Now, this is provided you've gone to a doctor and, you know, there's nothing physically wrong, okay? I'm moving that to one side. Provided there's nothing physically wrong with you. Provided you're not taking medication that could stop it, things like that. It usually comes from something in your head. And a lot of times, not being able to reach climax is because you're bored. The same old porn, same old topic, same old... You need to switch it up. You need to switch everything up. Stop looking at the same old porn. Pick something new. Try and go in a different direction. Check something out on the buffet table of life. Go over and try the other end of the table and see what it looks like. You'll find it's usually coming from staleness. I don't think it has anything to do with your age. I mean, there's men who are, you know, 70, 80 years old who are still able to reach climax, no problem. So don't forget that 50 used to be old. It's not now. Hell, 70 and 80 used to be old. It's not now. That's the craziness. It is if you think that way. But if you don't, age is really literally just a number, because things keep shifting and changing. Look at all the women who are having kids in their 50s. That's another reason why we as a species are lasting longer, which is weird, but it's true. So yeah, no, don't take that as, well, I'm turning 50 years old. First of all, Bella, happy birthday and way to go on turning 50. There's not a lot of people who will even see 50. So well done. But no, I would not say that it has anything to do with your age, my dear. Not at all. Just try and switch it up and pick something new to think about, something new to capture your interest. But thank you, Not Sissy Bell. Thank you, Not Sissy Bell, for writing that in. Whew, okay. Our next question is from Aspirilla. That's actually a really cool name. When you look at all the fetishes out there, what is the most addicting? If I were to guess, I would pick forced intox, because this one includes a substance like alcohol or other stimulant. What happens, and alcohol is not a stimulant, it's a depressant. What happens when you start sexualizing a fetish? Oops, that's two questions. That's okay. I always appreciate your pearls of wisdom. Oh, okay. Here, have some pearls. Have some pearls, Aspirilla. Alrighty, Roni. The most addicting fetish out there changes. So I think, again, we're trying to turn around and say, well, it's this. But the problem is, given another 6, 8 months to a year, that's going to shift and change again. So for a while, the most addicting was financial domination. For you, because my guess would be you enjoy forced intox, you're thinking it's got to be forced intox. Forced intox is good, but it's usually the most addicting. I'm still going to sit with financial domination, just based on the fact that it just seems to constantly always be a ribbon in things. It's always there. So I'm going to raise my hand and pick financial domination. Da, 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 da. Now, I will also say that based on everything that's going on right now, the other super insane fetish is BBC. Like right now, BBC is off the chain. BBC, humiliation, all of that shit is off the chart right now. So again, it's going to fluctuate. One minute it's this, the next minute it's that. Here's a good one, put out an audio for Foot Cuck was the last audio I put out, based on obviously foot fetish. It hasn't sold worth a shit. And this is how you can tell, is through sales. Okay. So it's like the most popular fetish of all fetishes of all time has always been feet, because it's just so common. You would think a foot fetish audio would then sell, but it's not. So you see what I'm saying? It's going to fluctuate depending on what people want in that particular time frame. I'm still going to put out financial domination as being numero uno. I'm going to follow it with BBC and, you know, guys letting themselves be taken over by BBC. Those are my two. I wouldn't say forced intox. Forced intox works with financial domination, obviously, because it's going to take and shift and alter your mind. Hypnosis is another one. Hypnosis is some that guys really, really like. Now, what happens when you start sexualizing a fetish? Well, sweet pea, fetishes are already sexual. A fetish is a sexual attraction to an object or a thing. That's why we throw the word fetish around for everything, and it doesn't really work. So if you have a fetish, it's already sexualized. So it's not about sexualizing a fetish. You can sexualize something that isn't fetish, but a fetish is already sexualized. So it's already there. Now, you could, let's see, here's my cell phone. You could fetishize your cell phone. Men have done it. Ask any doctor in an emergency room. And you go, well, what are you talking about? Because you can always put this thing on vibrate and shove it up your ass. Yeah, I said it. And yeah, it's been done many times. So can you sexualize, say, a cell phone? Absolutely. There have been people who have sexualized their cars. So you can sexualize anything on this planet. And there is that saying that says, for every object on this planet, there is someone who has a sexual attraction to it. So, and I've seen a lot of really fascinatingly different fetishes, with different really bizarrely bizarre objects. Towels. That's a good one. Towels. Stuff that you go, whoa. It has nothing to do with sex. Well, that's the whole point. Now you're sexualizing something that wasn't meant to be sexualized. But a fetish, if you have a full fetish, the sex is already there. So there you go. Here's some pearls. Have some pearls. Go sell them. Thank you so much, Aspirella. I really appreciate you writing in. Our next question comes from Gluteus Maximus. I fucking love you guys. Honest to fucking God, I love you guys. Okay, I love it when you write in, because I never know what you guys are going to call yourselves and stuff. It's so great, because you guys are so clever. Hi, doctor. Is it normal not to have an erection during strap-on play? When having my bubbly bottom in the air, you guys rule. When having my bubbly bottom in the air and face down is a very erotic position for me. Yes, it would be, because it's very vulnerable and it puts you in a very submissive state. My wife loves to egg me on, so to say. As soon as she slides the strap on in, I lose my erection, excitement, and freeze and try to breathe through it. It feels very full. Want to get through this and enjoy being taken, but I feel like we, or I should say, have hit a wall. Okay. Any suggestions? Thank you. Got it. Okay. What you're doing is exactly, you're in your head. It happens to everybody. And that's the first thing. Whenever someone's trying something new or doing something different, you're always going to be in your head for a while. And when it comes to anal, boy, do you boys go into your head. What you're doing is you're running into your own, very good, your own programming. You're in your head, therefore you're not allowing yourself to enjoy what you're feeling. So part of that is going to come from that I shouldn't have something in my ass. Real men don't let anything in their ass. Okay? That bullshit. So that's programming, right? So that's going to come up when it's happening. the feeling of fullness. First of all, things going in that direction feels weird. Okay, because it's like, that is an exit, not an entrance. So until you get used to it, yes, you're going to feel full. You're going to feel really weirded out, almost. You can actually, sometimes that feeling of fullness is because you need to take a crap. Now, this is going to sound really nasty, but you don't know. There's certain things that you can do to help fix this. So number one is start looking at your programming and saying, okay, what is real and what isn't? All men love things in their butts. Why? Because we can play with your prostate, and your prostate's your clitoris. So of course it's going to feel good, but you have that programming stuck there going, oh, real men, don't do this. Don't do this. If you do this, you'll turn into an instant faggot. It's like, okay, that isn't what happens. Can't be done. So shoving something up your ass should just be pleasurable. The feeling of fullness can be because you have too much shit in you. My suggestion is before you play that way, if you don't already, do an enema because it helps get that feeling of fullness out. It cleans you out. Obviously, it makes it a lot nicer when you're getting fucked. So try doing an enema. And the last thing I would suggest you start doing, just for a little while, not forever, is try some poppers. Now, poppers, although, yes, they're not good for you for the long term, but a popper, the reason why they were so big and are still big within the gay community for decades is because it helps to relax the anal sphincter. So that's what poppers were used for. You breathe in the popper and it relaxes you. Okay, so you could try a bottle of poppers. You don't want to leave the lid off, because if you're new to this, if you leave the lid off, it's all alcohol-based and it just evaporates and now you've just spent money for nothing. So always remember to keep your thing on, your lid on. Take a deep breath, put your lid back on, hold it for a couple of seconds, let that breath out, let your body feel that floatiness, feel yourself going into it. You're going to feel yourself, especially if you're in ass up, head down, you're going to feel your body get a little bit heavier and more relaxed. And then she's going to be able to slide that thing in really super easily. You're not going to feel as freaked out by it. And I think in the long run, it's going to help you. Do I think you should do this every single time you ass fuck? No. This is just to get you over the hump, if you will, of getting out of your head. Because it really does help relax you and will take away that, because you're losing your erection, like you said. You're losing your erection. And again, it's that feeling of things aren't supposed to, you know, enter at an exit. I feel full. It feels weird. What is it? Ew, this is just so odd. Why does this feel so weird? You're in your head. At that point, you're in your head. And how are you going to get out? So again, this is all you just having shit stuck in your head that you is not serving you. It's not serving you anymore. Who cares? Who cares what's in your ass? Nobody cares, right? Nobody knows it's in there other than you and your wife. So let's, again, pull the shame out of it. Because there's a lot of shame involved in men with ass play. So you got to pull the shame out of it and then turn around and go, is this serving me? Is this shame serving me? No, it's not. How is this shame serving me? No one knows what you're doing. The only person giving you shame is you. So pull that back. So let's get rid of the shame. Try doing the enema. Try cleaning yourself out. And try the poppers and see if it relaxes you enough to allow you to feel this. Eventually, what will happen is you'll start feeling the sexual excitement coming from that particular dildo, hopefully rubbing against your prostate. If that's not working, get a dildo that's slightly curved so that we know we're hitting the prostate. So like, there's a lot of little different things, but to me, this screams you're stuck in your head and we need to get you out of your head. Okie dokie. Hope this helps Gluteus Maximus with your bubbly bottom up in the air. Lovely. Okay, thank you so much, Gluteus, for sending that in. Seriously, that's a really good one because it happens to everybody. I mean everybody. Especially the first time you try anal, it's just like, whoa, 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 this is too freaking weird. So it's normal to get stuck in your head. You just got to kind of pull yourself out of that. And I really do think the poppers in this case would help you do that and loosen up a bit more. So our next question is from Eric. Eric says, I think your show is great and I enjoy listening and learning. Well, good for you. Thank you very much for listening. I'm 25 and struggling a little with penis size. Oh, you and every other male on the planet. I thought the average male is about 6 inches, or maybe it's 5.5. I read most women do not really care about size. Then I listen and read from your side and I hear my 6-inch willy is on the small side. Not sure if I'm measuring right. Am I making a big thing out of nothing? Can't help but feel inadequate. Aw. Especially after watching porn, which I find myself watching more and more. Oh, my darling. Okay. Part of your feeling inadequate is watching the porn. So in this case, what I would have you do is pull back on your porn. Here's the thing. A 6-inch penis is average. The average penis size being 5.5 to 6.5. So you're dead bang in the middle of average. Is that a bad size? No. Most women enjoy 7 inches and more. It doesn't mean that 6 inches isn't worth anything. That's bullshit. Okay? You get down into 2 and 3 and 4 inches. Well, now we're talking, there's not much point. But 6 inches is perfectly fine. That's like an average white guy. So unless you are black and you're dealing with, oh my God, you know, I'm supposed to have a fucking 12-inch dick and I don't, which I'm guessing that isn't the deal here. There is nothing wrong with having a 6-inch penis. Do most women care about penis size? It depends on the woman. I would love to say that all women don't care. That's not true, because a lot of women do care. A lot of women will look at a 4-incher and just keep walking. It depends on the female. Now, there's females out there who will say, well, I'll take the 4-incher because he's going to work harder. So it's all in everybody's perspective. So if we're going to generalize this, generally speaking, women want 7 inches and over, just generally speaking. But don't turn around and think that 6 inches isn't worth anything, because it is. There's nothing wrong with it. So maybe what you're doing, which is why I say I think you need to pull back on the porn, is from the fact that the porn that you're watching, you got to remember that anyone doing porn, I don't care what color they are, if it's a professional porn studio and we're not talking, you know, at home porn, these people are hired because they have large penises. Okay? It's a visual thing. The bigger the penis, the more money you make. Gotta remember, everything's based on money. What did we just learn? Okay, so what you're doing by looking at porn and then comparing yourself is you're comparing yourself to an unrealistic expectation, right? So if you're looking at, say, BBC porn and everybody on there is 9, 10, 11 inches long, how the fuck are you going to come out of that thinking your dick is great? You're going to come out there thinking, oh my God, this is horrifying. I'm so small. Everything is relative. Everything is relative. You're going to find a woman who thinks your 6 inches is the greatest thing since sliced bread, but you're not going to find her if you're always watching porn, boo-boo. So you got to pull yourself away from the porn, because right now what you're doing is you're comparing yourself to things that you cannot be. It's like being a cat and looking at dog pictures and going, well, how come I can't bark? There's something wrong with me. I can't bark. Well, you can't. You can't change what you were given between your legs. Stop trying to be something you're not. Stop trying to be the guy with the 11-inch dick, because I will tell you something right here and now. Anybody who is over 10 inches, okay, and I'm being very generous here because for a lot of women it's lower than that, like 9. Let's go 10. 10 inches and over? These guys don't get fucked either. Remember that. Oh, sure, you see them in porn, you see them fucking getting it, they're like banging and railing a bitch like nuts, and you think, well, how come I'm not doing that? Again, because we are allowing you guys, you're only 25, you're still a little fetus. And you are basing, you see how bad porn is for basing your sexuality. You can't. It's entertainment. It's not a way for you to measure your life. So this is the reason why it's better to pull yourself away from the porn, which you are comparing yourself to, which is like comparing apples to trucks. It makes no sense. And those guys are not getting laid as much, because when you get into 10, 11, 12 inches, most people are going to go, bye. I don't want that anywhere near me. Get that fucking thing away from me because it's too fucking big. So you got to understand that your really big guys don't get laid any more than your really tiny guys for opposite reasons, but essentially the same. Your it's too big or it's too small. You fall into almost, if we're going to do this the Goldilocks way, yours is just right. So let's stop with comparing ourselves to porn stars who are there to entertain, and let's go on with looking at ourselves and going, you know what? 6 inches ain't bad, because it's not. Could have been worse. So enjoy the 6 inches. Stop worrying about it. Some women do, some women don't care. Just get out there, stop watching porn. Fuck's sake, stop watching porn, get out and live your life. You're 25, you have your whole life ahead of you. Stop watching porn, you guys. Porn isn't real. So let's try and get out there and start living your life. Put the phone down, look up, and start living. That's what I want to see you guys do. Any hoodles? That brings us to the end of our show. I want to thank you, Eric, for writing that in. Very, very happy that you wrote that in. Seriously. I just want to thank each and every one of you who takes the time not only to listen to the show, but to send in your questions, because you got to understand that you may think that your question is stupid or anything. The point is it's not, because you don't know if your question is going to be helping someone else. So thank you for taking the time to send those in, and keep it up. Send them in some more. That does it, though. That does it for questions. Thank you to everyone who sent one in. I do really appreciate it. I appreciate you guys, even though you waited till the last minute. I hope you got a spark of hope from my discussion with Dr. Shermer Sellers. And you'll grab her books, go to her website, go to her social media, and start to heal. Because it's important to be happy, as I always remind you. Join me next month when I have a frank discussion about the freedom in making the decision to become pussy-free. That's on the July 9th show. Please feel free to read my articles and peruse my audios on the drsuereview.com, or join us all on Patreon. We have fun in there. Until next time, my friends, please learn to be kind to yourself, and always, always be reaching for your happy.
Have you felt unprepared or frustrated during a doctor's appointment because you didn't have your medical records on hand? The stress of waiting for your reports until your appointment can add to your anxiety. Pocket Health can help you take control with fast, easy online access to your medical imaging records. Receive personalized questions for your doctor, track follow-up recommendations, and use our report reader dictionary to better understand your medical results. Visit pockethealth.com to access your records. That's pockethealth.com.